Welcome back to Copper Country Today. I'm your host, Rick Gallen. And most people would agree that the Keweenaw area is a wonderful place to live. As it turns out, that some people don't quite feel the same way. And there's a fellow over at Michigan Tech that wanted to look into why that is. Joining me right now is Josh Lohr. He is putting together the Keweenaw Culture Project, and he's here to tell us all about it. Josh, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Rick.
Keweenaw Culture Project, as I was kind of just giving a brief intro there, am I kind of on the money there about how this got started?
Yeah, exactly right. You know, when I moved here, my wife and I've been here 5 years. People were very friendly, very welcoming. It's been a really lovely place to be, and people were really sort of open to us coming into the community. But as I talked to some of the students at Tech, particularly those who don't sort of match our demographic, I found that that wasn't the case for everybody. You know, looking at myself, I'm a white man with a beard. I wear flannel all the time. I look like I fit in pretty easily. My mom's family is all from the Ontario side of the Sioux. So we've got this kind of region in our blood. But I was talking with a friend of mine who's a graduate student from Iran, who definitely had an experience of feeling like they were not welcome in the community. Talking to some students who were of LGBT orientation and felt like they were not necessarily welcome in the community. And so I wanted to investigate why a place that could be so welcoming to me was not so welcoming to them.
All right, so let's just lay some groundwork here. Where did you come from? You said you've been here for a few years.
Yeah. Most recently I was in Los Angeles, but which is the area I'm from. I'd lived on the East Coast for 8 years. I worked in New York City for a long time as a sound mixing engineer for concerts. And then I had taught sound at Yale School of Drama. Moved back to Los Angeles where I was designing for theme park rides. And then missed teaching, and the opportunity to come up here opened up and we jumped at it.
All right, and what do you do at Michigan Tech?
I teach sound.
Teach sound, okay. Yeah. All right. So this seems a little bit out of your forte. What drew you to want to do this project?
It's a couple of things. I mean, it's a curiosity about this place that I've decided to make my home, that we've, you know, we bought a house. We want to be involved in the community. I guess part of it's also in my blood. My dad was a journalist, and so I sort of grew up around the idea of interviewing people as a way to get at some story that you were interested in. And I just happened to have such interesting conversations with people. And part of it was that as I got to know more Youpers, people who had been there their whole lives, I got really interesting stories about the place. And, you know, I've lived a few different places, and I've never lived somewhere where a lot of the people are so passionate about loving the place that they are. And so that was an interesting contrast to me. Why is it that people can be so excited about the Keweenaw and so in love with the Keweenaw, and that also have some people who don't share that?
I think one of the advantages to the job that I do is that I hear many different viewpoints. I get to interact with many different social circles.
Sure.
And, you know, certainly there's the element here where we have like the Parade of Nations. And of course, we've got a very, very diverse body of student bodies at Finlandia University and at Michigan Tech. And so I'm like you, my initial response was, well, everybody here is just so welcoming and so wonderful. And for the most part, I would say the most part, I still feel that that's true.
Yeah.
But over the going on 7 years that I've been in this area, there have been incidents that have drawn out the other opinions, you know, whether they've been students from out of the area who have gotten into trouble here and, you know, because they're not used to functioning here in the, you know, in the Keweenaw's culture.
Sure.
Also with things that have happened on the different campuses, and the response from certain elements of our community has been very negative towards those people.
Right.
And I, for one, was shocked because I didn't, you know, I felt that at the time, you know, that most of the people were very understanding, very open, you know, and treated, you know, the students, whether, you know, regardless of their ethnicity, their racial background, their sexual orientation, that we were, you know, very open. And I think most of us are.
I think so.
But I have, again, like you, have talked to other people who are not me, who are not a straight mid-40s white male, who do not feel that the people here have been that opening to them.
Right. Well, and it's interesting. I mean, one of the reassuring things actually that's come out of this project, I mean, I've interviewed close to 100 people now over the course of the last year, and some of them have been international students. Some of them are freshmen who have just come here for the first time in their lives. Some have been people in their 90s who have lived here their whole life. So I've got a real range of experiences in our collection. And one of the things that keeps happening in that is that, for example, some international students, I've talked to some who are from Africa, who spoke about having the N-word hurled at them in public places here, but also that they felt that that was an exception, that they, being outside of America's history of race and struggle, looked at it and said, I actually had someone say to me, that wasn't about me. That wasn't actually directed at me, even though that person thought it was. That was someone who is ignorant and who doesn't have the experience of someone like me. And I understood that, and I just sort of let it roll off me. And I was really, impressed with that kind of generosity of response. I mean, I don't know if I would be that generous if someone was hurling insults at me in public. But that also speaks to the rest of our community and how welcoming they have been. There have been exceptions. There are several people I've spoken to who don't feel that way, but it's, you know, the majority of people, even those who have experienced some, you know, what I would refer to as hateful incidents, for the most part, still feel that they've been welcomed here with those exceptions. And that's a testament to the community, I think.
All right, we're going to dial down here in a moment to some of your findings from doing this project and how other people can participate as it carries on.
Surely.
But, you know, you mentioned that you were in Los Angeles and over on the East Coast. I myself am from the Detroit area.
Sure.
And so we have some experience living in areas that were very diverse as far as community.
Definitely.
And I'm wondering if you found the same thing. One thing I found is that just because you had larger populations of different communities did not translate into people getting along more. In fact, it was probably a little bit more of the opposite that I found is here, even though it's, you know, you've heard, you know, I don't know, you probably heard people refer to it as the Great White North.
And right.
Stuff, okay? but I have found that people living here have the tendency to be more tolerant than those that were in a more diverse community in the Detroit, perhaps because there was more competition between the different ethnicities.
That's possible. I've had some variety of that experience. When I was living in Connecticut, I felt like that was, and I've worked in the North and the South and the East and the West, Connecticut was the most racist place I'd ever been. There were definite separations, segments of town where it was like, that's the black area and you don't go there if you're a white person, and there's the white area that's this area, you don't see black people on the street in that area, and there was definite separation. Living in Los Angeles is a weird case because it's people think of it as a city, but it's really just a sprawling set of suburbs all smashed together. And so there's some areas of Los Angeles that were very diverse and very inclusive, and some areas that were less so. New York also had some of each. You know, there are some neighborhoods that felt very inclusive and some that definitely did not, that there was that competitive aspect about it. And so that's, yeah, I don't see this as being, you know, exceptional particularly, with the exception to that people are very friendly here. That's one thing, even people who felt like they're not necessarily welcome would attest over and over again that people are friendly on the whole, even if they felt like they weren't being necessarily included, which, you know, some people have straight up said, well, is that just that Midwest, that Northern niceness? Is that false? Is that real? From my own experience, it doesn't seem like on the whole it's false, but, you know, that's part of why I wanted to ask these questions, I guess.
Right. Now, for some of the people that come here, especially referring to international students, you know, it's a huge culture shock. My daughter is a student at Michigan Tech, and she says, you know, she goes to school with some people that were from Southern India,
right?
And they've never seen snow here,
right?
You know, they didn't see snow when they decided to come here. They came here, of course, it's usually pretty nice, cooler certainly in September when they start school. Then all of a sudden, the snow hits, and they've never seen it before.
Yeah, and then we get 300 plus inches. Yeah, I interviewed a student from Southern India just last week, and he was talking about the same thing, saying that his biggest complaint about the Keweenaw was just the weather. He's like, I love this place, but I can't stand it. It's May. We have to stop with the snow.
So there's no over-exaggerating, I guess, the effect of the weather on, you know, people, especially if they're not from even the Northeast.
Well, yeah, there's snow in Connecticut and New York. It's nothing like here. You know, I never owned a snowblower when I lived back there. And when I moved here, my wife and I shared one car, and I talked to my colleagues and said, well, we need to buy a second car, but we also probably need a snowblower. Which should we do first? And they go, snowblower. And man, that was the right choice.
I never
regretted that decision.
So how would you characterize, in general, the responses that you were getting, the testimonies, I guess, from the different people you talked to, you know, if you were to put us on a scale of 1 to 10 and 10 being, you know, a very tolerant, very open place and 1 being the deep South, where would you put us? You
know? Probably somewhere around 7 or 8.
Okay.
Which is good. You know, I think that most of the country falls somewhere between 4 and 7, and we're on the high end of that in terms of tolerance and inclusion. You know, there's not, there are racist incidents. There are racist statements that get posted on flyers. There are racist comments made on internet forums. I don't think that's something that's not happening in the rest of America. And I did find myself surprised continually by people who are from very different environments who continually said, you know, on the whole, people have been very nice here. There was this one time. You know, and there's a lot of that that I heard. There's, you know, people have been very nice, very friendly. I'm very happy to be here. Well, there was this one time.
Yeah, and you're referring to like blatant racist interactions, not just not feeling included or the white privilege argument or anything. You're talking about people when they were actually targeted.
At times, yes. And we did have people talk about sort of the more white privilege scenario where they felt like, well, someone wasn't going to call out, you know, a hateful name to me, but I didn't necessarily feel like I was ready to be included in everything here. Part of it is interesting, you know, being a professor at Tech, you know, I did get a bunch of response from Tech students and faculty and staff, as well as people out in the community. And there has been some difference there too. One of the things that international students repeatedly say is how welcoming the international student programs have been at Tech. And so that, you know, even if they have experienced some other incidents or other feelings out in the community, they knew they were welcome on campus and they knew that they were supported, and that if there was a problem, they could go to the Center for Diversity and Inclusion, or they could go to the International Student Programs Office, or these people who, you know, by no means would make them feel like what they had experienced was their fault or anything like that. And so I think the campus is doing a lot of work to try and make the diversity in its midst feel very welcome. But we have a disconnect between the campus and the community. And that's not uncommon, I think, in college towns, to see, you know, a campus that becomes its sort of insular world and doesn't reach out enough to the community. I think Tech tries, but it doesn't always succeed necessarily at bridging those gaps. And so there's a sort of town and gown feeling that happens. And so people from the Tech community, you know, to the extent that they experience the outer community, their experience varies. Some of the international students, you know, they get here and if they're in their first year, they're so overwhelmed with their graduate studies or whatever it is, you know, they don't find themselves out in the community very much. They're studying and then it's snow and they're in their dorm or the library and they're back in class. And then the year is up and they're back in where they came from, whatever nation, you know, they've gone home to. And so that's been an interesting thing too, is seeing, you know, to what extent do people involved with the campus actually reach out past that campus. And talking to some people who are not involved with the campus, you know, there's been a clear sentiment that the answer is probably not enough.
Well, we'll get to what can the community do to improve that here in a moment. I want to ask, you know, we've been talking basically about race and ethnicities, international students and minority students. Well, let's talk a little bit about the, you know, those that would be involved in the Keweenaw Pride, you know, whether they're the LGBTQ community. I've had guests here from Keweenaw Pride and here on this show to talk about, okay, well, let's, you know, let's start creating a dialogue, let's start creating understanding. You know, we do live in a bit of an isolated community when it comes to, you know, different walks of life. They're here.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, it's all, you know, everything that you would ever find in any big city is here.
Absolutely.
On a smaller scale, maybe not as out in the open, but it's definitely here.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, that's been an interesting part of this process too. In the conversations, I've talked with several people who are out as, you know, an alternate to cis gender, you know, sexuality or gender identity that's fluid, gender queer, trans, people who are, you know, other than the sort of binary left, right, male, female boxes. And for those who are a little more traditionally aligned within that subcategory, someone who is, for example, a homosexual man, you know, some have felt, okay, I can affiliate with Keweenaw Pride. There's some support here. But for those who are outside of that next most easy to understand box, particularly those who are trans or genderqueer, have expressed to me a lot of sort of difficulty even relating with Keweenaw Pride, feeling that there was sort of an exclusive, sort of cliquish nature there that wasn't actually as inclusive as it pretended to be. And that was really interesting to me, talking with someone who felt like, I had one person who's, you know, who's, one of the options for the interviews is to keep your identity confidential. But one person who spoke to me said, you know, they felt that there was, some clear hatred toward them in the community. They were an out trans person, gender queer person. But at the same time, their biggest surprise and their biggest problem was with so-called leftists who felt like they had already done the work and were already as inclusive as they needed to be, but still somewhat shunned them and still were judgmental of choices that they were making that should have been none of their business. And so that I found interesting also, that, you know, we obviously have, as part of a campus community, as typical of a lot of campus communities, whatever kind of school it is, you know, there are some progressive people, there are some left-leaning people. And to find that I had several people saying that they felt like that was actually one of the problems with the community, was that those on the left feel like they're farther ahead in their inclusion and their attitudes than they actually are. And so that was something I hadn't expected necessarily. An interesting result, though.
Well, when you take that off the campus and into the community, I assume that the inclusiveness drops down considerably when you're talking about the LGBT community.
I would imagine, yes. Yeah. And to some extent, that's geographic as well. You know, I've heard a lot of talk about how sort of in the bubble of Houghton and Hancock, you get the most sort of easy accessibility, the most sort of random standard inclusivity. And as you get either farther south or farther north, that starts to dwindle as you get away from the centers of campus.
Yeah, to more rural areas.
Right.
You can understand that, you know, at least that's what we see, you know.
Right, stereotypically.
You see that pattern cross country, sure.
Right. All right.
Well, you were talking about different things that the community, you know, needs to do, obstacles or improvements that the community can work on. What are some of those things based on those findings that you have?
Well, I think some of the work needs to be done in education and done early. I think that, you know, and I've heard a lot of young people who grew up here express this, that they felt like one of the reasons the place wasn't as inclusive as it could be was just because traditions get handed down. And that's the way it's always been done, and so it's the way it's going to continue to be done. And if there's no one introducing new ideas to young people when they're forming their identities, when they're forming their opinions, then they get even to high school and are, you know, fairly strong and rigid in their beliefs. And maybe those will be challenged, you know, as they grow older or if they go to university, and maybe they won't. But the idea that, you know, if we can enforce is the wrong word, but encourage more inclusivity from an early age. You know, the idea that there are a range of attitudes, a range of ways to live, and as long as we're all trying to sort of get along and not hurt each other, that's probably all right. And the, you know, the sort of traditions that get passed down here are not something that you want to abandon entirely. There's something beautiful about small communities and the fact that there are traditions, that there are ways that people live, that there are, you know, festivals and holidays and the things that make a small community beautiful. And at the same time, you know, I've heard a lot of tales of anti-gay bullying in the high schools. And if that's happening in the high schools, that means those attitudes formed before they got to high school. And so that's part of it, is just trying to, you know, introduce new ideas at early ages and broaden those horizons as soon as we can. Hmm.
I know that growing up, my views on the world were pretty limited. I wasn't exposed to a whole lot of things. Of course, this was, you know, growing up in the 70s and the 80s.
Sure.
And things, the tide was just beginning to turn.
Yeah.
And it was, really was upon me as an adult to force myself to change, to become more open-minded to things that were not part of my immediate world.
Right.
And I can tell you, if I can do it, then anybody can.
Yeah.
But really, you know, is there any place in our future society for those old, you know, for that old mindset? I mean, could you even really continue to function with that, you know, old intolerable bigoted view on things and be functional. I mean, I don't see how there's any place for it going forward, even if it's not really what you want.
Right.
Okay. It just doesn't seem like going forward, there's really going to be any place for, you know, to be able to continue to think that way, to be bigoted, homophobic, transphobic. It's all changing, whether you like it or not.
Absolutely right. Yeah. No, I mean, I see this as one, you know, we're continuing the civil rights struggle, essentially. And one of the things growing up in California, people sort of see themselves, talk about a group of sort of leftists that think they've done the work. The idea that, you know, we've gone through the 60s and the 70s with the nominal civil rights era, and that work is done now. We could have a black president. It's all finished, right? You know, well, all the claims of post-racial America are obviously not true, as we've seen in the last few years. And I think you're correct. I think if we're going to actually move forward as a culture, we don't accept hatred. We don't accept that kind of bias, that kind of exclusivity. You know, and there's a difference between someone who doesn't want personally to be a homosexual and someone who doesn't want to accept homosexuals as human beings. You know, I have no problem with what you want to do in your own bedroom, whether it's straight or not. But I also think that, you know, if we can actually talk to each other and actually hear each other's stories, that was one of the big reasons I wanted to record these stories. And these recordings I've made will, after they're post-produced, will be part of the MTU archives and they'll be free to listen to anybody, is that these are all human beings. We're all just human beings who are trying to do the same things. We're trying to wake up in the morning and have a good breakfast. We're trying to figure out a way to make a living. We're trying to find a way to find love in our lives, to have a fulfilling life. You know, we all share these same goals. And I think if we can come to the point that we're having that conversation and identifying that we all share those same goals, that shared humanity helps overcome those problems. Because, you know, if you look at someone who has a different sexual orientation or a different ethnic background as that category, and you've placed them in that category before you've placed them in the common category of human being, then that's a division that you have to overcome. But if we can place ourselves all in that common category of humanity, we can see that we're really more similar than we are different. Even people with wildly divergent political views, if you get down to the baseline, are ultimately more similar than they are different. I really believe that. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to collect stories, is to say that we're all saying the same things, ultimately. How we want to live in the minute to minute varies, but how we want to live over the course of years is pretty much the same. And I think that's what can join us together and can help us get over these sort of demographic baskets we place each other in.
Good words.
Appreciate Thank you.
Are you done interviewing people?
Well, technically the project was to interview people for a year and then move into the post-production phase, but I've found it so fascinating that I'm still taking candidates as time allows.
All right. Well, if somebody does want, they have a story to share and they think it's going to help your research, how do they get a hold of you?
Send me an email at KeweenawCultureProject@gmail.com.
Okay. And how are the findings you mentioned about being in the archives? I guess, what is the goal? What are you planning on doing with all this information other than storing it?
Well, we're going to collect it and analyze it. Next year, probably later in the academic year, I'll be holding a couple of public forums, at least one on campus and one probably farther up the peninsula, to discuss what we found. We're going to be inviting people who were interviewed and the rest of the community to sort of have just an open chat about it, and talk about how, as a community, we're getting along or not getting along. And then my background is in the arts. And so in the third year of the project, we're going to be using some of the stories from the interviews to create a new stage play that we're going to produce at Tech.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
When you were collecting the interviews, you had posters that I know that I've saw on some pictures of them that talked about, you know, do you really love living in this area? And then another one was, do you really hate living in this area?
Right.
Have you seen any backlash from doing this?
No. There was one person who, you know, after I explained the goals of the project, said, oh, so you want to be lynched? I said, well, that's a bit extreme.
I see you don't.
No, I don't think anyone does. But that person wasn't, you know, expressing their own sentiment. They were saying, oh, you're going to stir up trouble. That's your...
Yeah. But it certainly then helped open the doors and begin a conversation for a lot of people maybe that we're not going to have an avenue to express the things that they were able to share with you safely.
Surely, yeah. And that's been part of the project as well, is the idea that you can remain with your identity confidential. And if you do that, what we do is the file is stored encrypted with a password, and when it gets post-produced, the vocal tone is altered, all the proper nouns are taken out, you know, Inside Edition style for those of us who are as old as we are. So you get that sort of anonymity before it goes into the archive. So there have been people who have shared some very interesting stories with us because they were able to do so without thinking it would come back and connect to them. So for anyone listening who would like to share stories, if you're worried about that, that's always an option.
And lastly, just your impression, if you've attended the Parade of Nations, the Multicultural Festival, when you see that, does that give you, you know, hope that, hey, overall we're at least doing better than some of the stories?
It does. And one of the biggest things that gives me hope about it is the students who have participated in it talking about it. And many of them feel that it's, you know, while it's a first step and it's not, you know, it's a shallow representation of culture rather than a deep representation, it's a representation and it's a place for them to feel welcome and to feel celebrated in the community. And a lot of people feel very positively about that.
Awesome. Josh Lohr from the McEwen All Culture Project and at Michigan Tech, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Copper Country Today, we'll be right back.